I invite you to come to the microphone.
You mentioned the usher's tone.
Yes.
It wasn't in the what I was talking about tonight, but I will mention it. I've used to think that usher just took biblical chronology and put it together, and I found out about 10 years ago when they republished this thing, retranslated it, it's much more involved than that. He took the biblical chronologies and all the available secular chronologies and collated them with the assumption that the biblical was right. And while he's not right in everything he did, he his impressive work and much of what he did is spot on. And it's not the kind of thing you read. It's a reference book. And I've consulted a number of times, and I read sections of it. I bought it. Finally, I kept borrowing somebody's. I finally bought my own because it was so good. But even the late Stephen Jay Gould, a very famous evolutionist, 30 years ago wrote an essay when he pointed out that Usher's book was one of the most scholarly things in the 17th century. It was really top-notch. He gave his due to him. So he's not the fool that he sometimes, Usher's not the fool that people sometimes portray him to be. No. Anyway.
So please come and make a line at the microphone and ask your questions so everyone can hear it. Thank you.
The Big Bang, the physics of it, I mean, it just seems incredible that all this mass of the universe went down to the size of a photon. And, of course, they cannot duplicate this in the lab. So how does the physics work in this thing?
Well, it's not so much as it went down into this. The universe starts off like that. Just it doesn't like it shrink down and pop back out. It just pops into existence one way. And the idea of it all being the size of a proton, it all depends on which version you're talking about. Those are kind of estimates put on it. There's one idea that the universe is infinite, in which case that it was never the size of a proton. It was bigger than that, but it expanded beyond that, which is kind of an odd concept to get your head wrapped around. But it's just in a very ultra-dense state. Whatever it is, it's very hot, very dense, and it just expands so rapidly from that it doesn't re-collapse on itself like in a supermassive black hole. It had to start off at a very fast expansion rate. And at that point, you're really pushing the physics to the limits because you're talking about very high densities, you're talking about very small distances, and that really starts bringing in elements of general relativity and quantum mechanics. And there is no theory of quantum gravity. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to piece together what physics we have to try to describe this early event, that even then it's kind of a best guess as to how to proceed because our theories are not good enough yet to do that. So there is there are little gaps and conjectures thrown in there at points. It sounds so certain when you see it on a program on TV or read a proper account of it, but there actually are some little nitty-gritties that are problematic there. So if you have right to have suspicions about some of the physics at some point.
In many places in the Bible, God says he stretched out the heavens.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a reference to the expansion that we see?
I used to think that a lot. It's talked about in several of the poetic and several of the prophetic books. It's a very broad range of Old Testament passages, some of the stretching of the heavens. And again, it's a very popular belief that that's talking about the expansion. I've come around in recent years to thinking that it's probably talking about a process that occurred during the creation week, primarily on day four, perhaps, because some of those tenses in Hebrew can be difficult, but some of those texts seem to imply that it was a past tense, and even translated as a past tense. He stretched out the heavens. And that's the case. I'm thinking it's more of a creation week, and then maybe the expansion is maybe a residual of that day four, or at least creation week processes.
In trying to explain what the Big Bang people believe, he made a statement that everywhere was smaller at one point, and I saw one time a friend of mine, he had this thing where the Earth itself is expanding.
Mm-hmm.
Can you make a comment about this? This smallness and this expanding, maybe the Earth is expanding too, according to them, or
well, the idea that some people have suggested, you know, that everything is expanding, including the Earth, including the scientists, including the telescopes they're using. But if everything's expanding, then you wouldn't see the expansion as the counter argument there. But the idea of expansion is that the universe expands on a very gradual scale. You don't really notice it locally. For instance, I like to make the example of tides. Tidal forces are extremely feeble. You don't see tides in your bathtub. You don't see tides in lakes and streams. You wouldn't see it in the ocean, except that the oceans are very large. And so when you multiply that very feeble tidal effect over thousands of miles of ocean, it begins to add up, pile up quite nicely. And that's why you get the tides. It requires a large body of water. And expansion of the universe is the same way. It's a very feeble force locally. But when you multiply that expansion over vast distances, it begins to add up at that point. And locally, gravity can totally swamp that sort of thing. In the solar system, gravity is so much stronger. The sun is so much stronger than the expansion term that it's just negated entirely. And the Earth's surface, gravity of the Earth is so strong it's negated. Only the vast distances between galaxies does it really begin to show up. And you need to go out on scales of probably on the order of 10 million light years before you start really seeing it add up at that point. It's amazing how that works.
You know, there's so many scientific observations we can make today. For instance, the sun being consumed, mm-hmm. Sedimentation and erosion. Why don't scientists say, well, the Earth can't be billions of years old, it wouldn't be here, it would be completely different than what we see?
Well, because we've committed evolution, and evolution takes billions of years, because otherwise we would see it taking place before our eyes, and we don't see it. So if it happened, it must have happened very slowly. And if it's not evolution, then you have creation, which gives you back that responsibility and accountability issue. That's what really the whole thing is. On the line there. And when it comes to evidences that we've put forth that the world is not nearly billions of years old, but far younger than that, they reinterpret that. They say, well, this is unusual. They give an explanation. It's a rescue device to try to explain why this is not really a valid argument to use at all. And it all depends on which argument you want to believe.
But, you know, we know the sun is shrinking, so...
Well, no, we don't know that. That's a common belief among recent creationists, but that's not a good argument, I don't think, with the shrinking sun. That's really not a good argument at all. There are some other arguments you can make about the sun, but that's not one of them. But there are other arguments. If the sun is billions of years old and getting its energy from nuclear reactions, and I think it is getting its energy from nuclear reactions, not shrinking, you have what's called the Young-Sun-Faint paradox. The sun should have been far dimmer in the past. It should have gotten brighter over billions of years, which have heated the Earth up tremendously. And that's a real problem. But if it's only thousands of years old, it's not a problem. So there are many evidences we use, but then they try to explain it away by saying the atmosphere of the Earth has changed somehow to magically counterbalance that changing brightness of the sun. They'll argue other things. So that if you find problems with radiometric dating methods. Like, for instance, we found that coal contains radiocarbon, which indicates the dates of tens of thousands of years old, yet the coal is supposed to be on the order of 300-400 million years old, something like this. They just argue it's contamination that's gotten in there. So they always have a comeback. They always have a response, and it's because if what we're teaching, what we believe is true, then it compels people to make a commitment or make a decision here. It really does. I mean, it's a spiritual problem. It's not a head problem. It's a heart problem. You can lay out the data all you want. I have a good friend of mine who went to college and went to the University of Chicago, which is a very prestigious hotbed of atheism. He studied geology and stuff there. He then went on to Harvard, where he got a PhD in paleontologist, studying under Stephen Jay Gould, who was a very famous paleontologist. Evolutionary Marxist and atheist paleontologist, and he knew this fellow was a recent creationist the whole time, and yet they were good friends because he was a good student. But his name is Kurt Wise, by the way, and he told me several times when he was in college, University of Chicago, back in the 80s, probably early 80s, I'm going to guess, he got a reputation pretty quick for being the crank creationist, but he was sharp, and he would go to dinner at the dining hall. And people would come around and they would engage in conversations. And there were people who were there the entire 4 years he was there. And the conversations were about creation and evolution and stuff, and he had good arguments and, you know, argued them quite persuasively. And people, he almost sold tickets, people would come to this thing every night. They'd, let's go see a recruit Kirk talk, you know. And he said that when graduation rolled around, after 4 years, his student came up to him, shook his hand, thanked him for all the time he spent and the conversation. I really enjoyed it. And he said, I must admit, you've really demolished everything I had to say. You've made a very good case. But I'm still going to believe in evolution. That makes, you said, whoa, it makes, I thought he was going to be a convert. No, no, it makes no sense intellectually, because the problem is, he understood that if what Kurt was telling him and the Bible was right, then there is a God, there is a creator, and he has expectations on our lives, and you have to deal with that. And the best way for him to deal with it was to deny it was ever an issue, even though he admitted that intellectually that was the reasonable thing to do. So it's a hard problem. That's ultimately the answer to your question.
I've heard it said this way, that a wise scholar once said that a man's morality dictates his philosophy, or a man's morality dictates his theology.
Yeah, absolutely.
How can I believe in God if I want to continue on this immoral lifestyle?
That's it. Yeah, and there have been people who have actually admitted that they wanted to. Who was that? I read recently and said that. It was about 40 years ago they said, wrote this. Just, you know, if this isn't true, then I've got real problems. It's getting away in my sex life, is basically what he said. Mm-hmm. And that was his response. That was his morality driving his theology, everything.
Huxley said something.
It was Huxley. That's who it was. Yeah, it was Huxley. Julian, I believe, that said that. And it was a statement. It was in the 60s, I think, he said that. You're right. That's who it was. So that was a candid admission. Nobody saw that one coming.
So another question. So the expansion of the world may still be happening, but not using the Big Bang Theory. And then we look at something like the moon. I know a little bit about it, but you can explain it better than I can try to. And if you explain that and then comment on how would a person who believes in the Big Bang negate what you were going to tell us about the distance of the moon, how far it is away, how much time it would take?
What you're referring to is that the moon is receding from the Earth. This is something that's we've measured from reflectors on the surface of the moon. We could bounce left over the Apollo program. We reflect light off the from a laser beam, we send it through a telescope to the moon and back. The time delay between the sending of the signal and receiving gives you the distance of the moon very precisely. A lot of data reduction goes in, but they found out that the moon is receding at a rate of about 4 centimeters per year. And the physics is well understood driving that. It's a very steep function of distance, so it's the inverse 6th power of the distance. And it's very straightforward to solve a differential equation for that to determine when the moon and the Earth would have been in contact in the past. And it's like 1.3 billion years ago. And so if you run this thing backwards, the Earth and the moon were together back then. And actually, before you get back that far, like 1.1 billion years, the tides on the Earth would have been a mile high. And so nobody believes that those conditions ever were met in the past. So it would seem that that evidence alone would argue that the Earth and the Moon are less than a little over a billion years. It can't be anywhere near 4.5 billion years old, which is 4 times longer than that because of this very stiff restriction. I think it's a very good argument. Well, the response I get from people that have given it to me is that we live at a time of unusually high tidal interaction, and we have for 900 million years. But for more than 3, almost 4 billion years prior to that, the Earth and the Moon were locked into a tidal lock, they say. And when I ask them, where's the evidence for that, they refer me to computer simulations. And, I mean, you snicker, and I snicker, but and I said, that's not data, that's a simulation, which all a simulation proves is that the simulator was able to produce the results it was trying to get, you know. They're showing how it might have happened. They haven't shown you that it didn't happen. That's a big difference. And that's the kind of response you get. It's a rescuing device. They explain it away every time. And to them, it's intuitively obvious that the world is very old, so they think we're just dead. Again, it's a hard problem. Yeah?
Can you explain how life on this star is taking billions of years to reach Earth?
All right. Very good question. I've been waiting for someone to ask that one. It gets asked a lot. It's called the light travel time problem. I left this picture up for this reason. That picture is incredible. It's the Hubble Deep Field. There are a few stars in there, but most of those little smudges of light you see are very distant galaxies, each one containing a few hundred billion stars, perhaps. And estimated, we don't even know the distance of these things. We can't measure it, but estimated 8 to 10 billion light years. All right? Even the Andromeda Galaxy, which is on my title slide, is 2.5 million light years away from us, and pretty easily you can see, well, wait a minute, you're saying the creation is 6,000 years old, so how can we see the light at all? That's of anything, you know, farther than 6,000 light years. That's almost universally how people frame this problem, but actually I think the problem is improperly formulated. It's even worse, okay? We're looking at it 6,000 years after creation and concentrating on the most distant objects in the universe. Instead, let's look at the beginning of the universe, like day 6 when Adam was made, and the nearest stars outside the solar system. The nearest star is more than 4 light years away. And so, how did Adam, at the end of day 6, beginning of day 7, look up at night and see the stars? Any of the stars! And I do believe that he did see the stars. He probably saw the sky pretty much the way we see it today, because on the day 4 account, it gives several functions that the stars must fulfill, and if not visible, they can't fulfill any of those functions. So the true way to solve this problem, to look at it, is not just how did light get here from the most distant objects in the universe, how did it get here from the closest objects at the end of creation week? Because again, 2 days won't get you 4 years in this approach. Well, there have been a number of supposed explanations, at least half a dozen that I'm familiar of that are out there. All of them have their advantages and disadvantages. They have people who like them. I've always been a little dissatisfied with them. So for years I've been searching. In the last 2 or 3 or 4 years, I've been coming up with an idea of my own. I've presented in small groups that I also finally published in July of this year. And I would suggest, if you want to learn more about it in depth, then go and read it. It's you need to go to the Answers in Genesis website. And that website is very simple. One word, answersingenesis.org. When the home page comes up, on the right side, click on the online research journal. Now, don't be afraid of research journal. Some of the articles are technical in there. This one is not. I intentionally wrote it so it would not be that technical. Does have some Hebrew in it. I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but I'll talk to many Hebrew scholars and help me out on this one, all right? I'll share with you just a few bits and pieces of it. First of all, the creation week was not ex nihilo in every aspect. I think in the very first day it says, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. He did create matter, space, energy, and time. Proof is there. But then he came back and shaped it. The word create is not used nearly that much throughout the rest of the week. On day 4, it's the word made. The Hebrew word is a song, not bara, so it's made rather than create. And many of the things were shaped and formed rather than just poof, ex nihilo, there's a tree, we're non-existent, or a whale, we're non-existent. It's the language there in the text is actually talking about some rapid processes taking place on each of the days of creation. Specifically, when you look at day 3 account, you have dry land that appears, and then it says, I think in verse 11, and God said, let the earth bring forth, and it mentions 3 types of plants. And the next verse, verse 12, says, and the earth brought forth, and mentions the same 3 types of plants. And I read that many times, and I always assumed it was probably the same Hebrew verb, different tenses. Imagine my amazement a few years ago when I looked it up and found out that the two words in verse 11 and 12 translated bring and brought forth, totally different Hebrew words, not related at all. You look up the meanings and they overlap tremendously to the point that the two words are synonymous with one another. You can use them interchangeably. Now the fact that the Lord saw fit to use two different words within the same thought, maybe you ought to draw attention to, maybe we ought to pay attention to what's what's being communicated here. Turns out, bring forth and brought forth is a good translation. The NIV, I believe, says produce, which is not bad. One of the earlier, more recent English translations says sprout, which I like, by the way. And other meanings of those two words are shoot and thrust. These are very dynamic terms. Reading all those possible meanings, I asked myself, well, if I were there, what might have I have seen on day three? And it comes across to me something like a time-lapse movie. You watch time-lapse movies of plants opening up, flowers opening up and stuff, and you see it in a matter of 30 seconds, something that may have taken days to happen. It's really entertaining, but also very instructive. Well, imagine if I'm looking, if you go back and read this for yourself this evening, see if you don't see it too, it talks about these things producing or springing or shooting or thrusting up. What I see is a little seedling popping out of the ground and gaining in height and gaining in girth, and branches come out and twigs and leaves and catkins and acorns. And growth that normally takes years but abnormally accomplished in maybe a few minutes, certainly less than a day, because that's all we had to work with. Why? Well, 3 days later, God's going to make squirrels that require those acorns to eat. For that matter, he's making in 2 days, some flying creatures that are going to need that, and certainly in three more days, man and animals too, that are going to require food. And the my understanding of gardening is when you have a seedling come up, it's a minimum of 6 weeks before you get any kind of fruit off of that particular plant, many times longer than that. If we had to rely upon normal growth, everybody would have starved to death. You know, to fulfill their functions, to provide food for man and beast, those plants had to mature very quickly. They weren't made mature. That's important. They weren't made mature. They matured quickly. God didn't say, poof, I created plants. He said, bring forth these plants. Bring them up out of the dirt. And that's the dynamic, rapid motion that I'm talking about here. So I go to the day four count. I'm saying, well, could the same sort of principle be working here? God makes those stars, and they're very far away. Why? I think probably because he wanted to impress mankind with his power. That's Psalm 19 and Romans 1, 19 and 20. It's a billboard advertising its existence and his power. So in order to get the light here, he had to produce that light, or he had to bring forth that light, or shoot or thrust that light. And so what I'm appealing to here is nothing short of a miracle. Something happened on day four that brought that light here. Did he mess with space? Did he mess with light? I don't know what he did. But he didn't do it with a physical mechanism. That's a mistake a lot of my fellow creation scientists make. They're looking for a physical mechanism to solve the problem. But we underestimate, seriously underestimate, the effects of the miraculous during the creation week. The whole thing was miraculous. And toward the end of the week, at some point, maybe in stages of the week, but certainly by the end of the week, the Lord transferred over to what we've learned in the New Testament is upholding the world by the sustaining power of his word. And that's what we consider to be physics today, the physical laws that work. And if you try to take those things that are sustaining now and apply them back to the creation week, I think you've made a grave error on this point. And so I'm not looking for a physical explanation. I'm looking for a supernatural. You might as well look for a physical explanation for the resurrection and in the virgin birth. And two more comments I'll point out there. Number one, I think, I don't know, I haven't got this all figured out in my mind. I may never, but probably never will be. But I think we're looking at the universe in something close to real time. That is, when I look at the Andromeda Galaxy, I'm seeing something. I know the distance is 2.5 million light years, but I don't think for a minute that the light has been traveling nearly that long. It's much shorter than that to get here. And number two, you mentioned the expansion of the universe and how I think it's a past process. I think that maybe that stretching out, that the word uses stretch, and we shouldn't think in terms of bungee cords and elastic things. It even says at one point that he stretched out like a curtain, or another place like a tent. And these things weren't elastic. They weren't nylon, you know, a bungee cord, rubber sort of things. Instead, they were made out of skins and cloth, and you would lay them out, you'd unroll them, you'd spread them like this. And I'm thinking that that's something that happened
during the creation week, the rapid bringing the light here was what that expansion was talking about, or spreading, I should say. That help?